Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
I'm going to repeat that.
Hi, I'm Debbie Brock, founder of Homeopathy World Community. I'll be speaking with our co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law. Today is March 24th, 2011. Thank you to our hundreds of listeners who join us each week on Thursday for Vaccinations and Your Rights in the United States. In addition to Alan, the second half of our show is going to be a special two-hour. We're going to have Manfred Mueller come on and talk about reverse chronological tautopathy, removing blocks to healing. So this special week, we have so much news, and we're thrilled that Alan is with us because he is a very active proponent of keeping your rights and health freedom, going ahead and interacting with many people in the United States about vaccinations and how you can effectively take care of waivers and exemptions. And also he is guiding many legislative actions and has been very active also in the networks for communities who are involved with these issues. Hi, Alan.
Good morning, Debbie. How are you this morning?
I'm doing okay. I am looking forward to learning about what's going on in New York State, about upcoming bills, about you mentioned something about a new study that verifies mercury in flu shots is toxic, and the Coalition for Mercury-Free Drugs. It's a nonprofit corporation. There are a lot of things out there that people need to become educated and aware in order to make good decisions in their life and in the lives of their children. So I'm going to let you begin with maybe announcements that you might have.
Well, let me first of all just make a quick apology for any inconvenience I may have caused you or any of your listeners with the change in schedule that happened pretty much last minute. And as I mentioned to you, I had something that I was just not able to rearrange. I have to be in court in a little while. And it's an unusual, but that's part of what goes with the practice of law. And so my folks, of course, if they miss this live, they can, of course, listen to the recording. So we'll proceed ahead. And thank you for doing the rescheduling. There is study you mentioned verifying that mercury in flu shots is toxic comes from PR Newswire, or the article that brought it to my attention is from PR Newswire. I keep on my Pandemic Response Project website a list of ongoing vaccine-related news items, and this is one of the latest ones that's listed there. But if folks are interested, we never have time, of course, on the show here to go into all of the relevant news that goes on. There's just constant stream of vaccine-related news on health and legal and legislative fronts. So that's at pandemicresponseproject.com. So just let your listeners know about that. And remind everyone that this is a weekly show. We're here every Thursday, usually at 12 noon Eastern time. But if we have occasional need to, hopefully not too often, to reschedule, of course, we'll do that and post that information. So the study about mercury and flu shots, this comes from ComEd, which is the Coalition for Mercury-Free Drugs, a nonprofit corporation that has as their goal and purpose to reduce, if not eliminate, mercury from drugs, including vaccines. They have a strong focus on concerns about mercury in vaccines. They've got a real top-notch researcher, Paul King, who a PhD, who works with them. And Paul is not only a top-notch researcher and, of course, a specialist in mercury-related health concerns, but he's one of the, in my opinion, an exception to the rule in medical people generally, in that he has a real good understanding of law and legal matters. CoMed has been involved in litigation over the years trying to further their goals and initiative of reducing or eliminating mercury in vaccines and other drugs. So they are good folks to stay in touch with. They, of course, have a website. You can find them with a quick search on Coalition for Mercury-Free Drugs, and I recommend them. But this latest article from the 22nd, March 22nd, says yet another peer-reviewed scientific study has proven the connection between mercury in medicine and human illnesses. And this is just the latest of six studies published in recent months, according to the article. So I wanted to bring that to the attention of your listeners. We hear a lot from quote-unquote authoritative sources or authorities downplaying, if not outright denying, the relationship between mercury and vaccines in particular and any health problems, and between vaccines and autism and other neurological conditions. And there's abundant research out there, and continues to be more, as this article brings to light.
Right, and when you talk about mercury, you're talking about thimerosal specifically, which is a component of the swine flu vaccine. And you know, when you look at the broad picture and you say they're telling us pregnant women should not consume fish because it has mercury, and we know that there are many other reasons like thermometers. They've eliminated doing the ones with mercury because it's toxic, and we know that this metal does have toxic effects to the body in the same way that lead and other metals do. And therefore, why would we be putting that particular element into our body when we know it has a cumulative effect? It builds up in the body and then can cause neurological damage. So we want to rethink this and take a closer look and understand how the production of vaccines can possibly be detrimental. By having these studies, we're getting more information.
Right, and as the president of CoMed, who is Reverend Lisa Sykes, points out at the end of this article, mercury is known to cause a serious harm, especially to fetuses and children, because of their smaller size. Why remove thimerosal from pediatric vaccines,
right,
only to inject it into pregnant women and children with the recommended,
right,
flu shots? And so, you know, again, of course, we know this in other and broader ways, but the conflicts between policy and science continue to be pervasive.
It's illogical, really. It boggles the mind. It's illogical to state it somewhere in health concerns and health care, and then in another place, it's not recognized in the same way. So is there anything else that we need to know about this particular Coalition for Mercury-Free Drugs that would be pertinent for us to learn?
Well, just that they're a good organization to be aware of and perhaps to even stay in touch with, and I recommend that folks take a look at their site, and they have lots of studies posted.
The URL it must be the HTTP, it's the / mercury-freedrugs.org, and it says welcome to CoMed. Is that the one you're talking about?
That sounds like it.
Okay, well, there's plenty of links on there and documentation, press releases, and contact information for anyone who's interested. Okay, so did you want to go ahead and talk? Did you have any further announcements about your particular website, activity, and actions that you're taking?
Well, just to remind folks that I do have two websites, vaccinerights.com, that is focused on vaccine exemption and waiver law and rights and information pertaining to that, and then the Pandemic Response Project, which is Pandemic Response Project, all spelled out, run together, .com. And that's focused on legislative initiatives with the primary focus being on emergency rights, because most states have laws that allow them to, in effect, throw vaccine exemptions out the window in a declared emergency and to quarantine unvaccinated people in locations of their choosing, which could be government facilities, and then potentially against the choice or preferences of those being quarantined. So we want to revise those laws. We're working on that here in North Carolina, as you know, Debbie, and supporting folks in other places. And meanwhile, I'm working to support legislative initiatives wherever I can, and especially where I'm invited to do that. And someone brought to my attention recently, now I had heard about this before, so this may not be the first time this bill was introduced in New York now, moving on to that issue. But I want to say to your listeners that if you're not in New York, then that's not a reason, or any of the other states that we talk about legislation going on, if you're not in those particular states, these are still important issues for all of us to listen to, because if it's not in your state now, your state may be next. There appears to be, if not ongoing, or recently, if not ongoing, you know, farther back, efforts around the country at the state law level to pass laws restricting exemption rights, and also trying to add more vaccines to the schedule, or other variations on those two themes. And the one in New York, is this particular one we'll talk about today, is the first time I've heard of this, or the only state that I've heard of this particular issue. But what they want to do is this, and let me just read a section from a current pending New York bill, and it says, a healthcare practitioner may provide health care related to the prevention of a sexually transmissible disease, including administering vaccines, to a person under the age of 18 without the consent or knowledge of the parents or guardians, provided that
that's
the person...
That's frightening.
Well, it's very frightening. In my analysis here, brief analysis, there's two fundamental problems with that. Provided that the person has the capacity to consent to the care without regard to the person's age and the person consents. So there's several problems with that, but the one that jumps out at us first is that they're talking about giving healthcare practitioners authority to vaccinate minors without the knowledge or consent of the parents.
It's unbelievable.
And the only condition on that is that provided this minor, this under 18 person, has capacity to consent to the care. What in the heck does that mean? Without regard to the person's age. So if the doctor has a five-year-old in there and wants to give him young girl, I mean, I'm sure this would involve teenagers predominantly, but it says without regard to the person's age. And one of the first things you learn in the practice of law or in the study of law is that you have to look at words very carefully and take them, you know, understand exactly what they're saying. And sometimes it's not so much what they say as it is what they don't say that matters here. Without regard to the person's age, that means anybody from birth to age 18 is what we're talking about here under that language, even though the reasonable first interpretation are they're talking about teenagers with, you know, sexually transmissible diseases or possible exposure to one. This bill raises serious constitutional concerns, and this I've done this with other bills recently, as you know, Debbie, and continue to do it here, and a proposed bill in New Jersey, I thought, but we had put that one to rest, and here it has come up again. Whenever there are constitutional issues, as a strategic matter, I think it's really important to bring those out, because as much as I would like to think that we can get enough people in terms of sheer numbers who are opposed to these kinds of absurd bills to speak out against them, I don't think we can rely on that. If you have a bill like this that the state health department supports and legislators generally will tend to go with the state and federal authorities, this is something that very likely would be supported by state and federal health authorities, perhaps not those who have that same same sort of parental, you know, people who are parents who see that should, regardless of what their views on vaccines are, should be saying, wait a minute, you know, whether you understand the law or constitutionality
or not. Like this, how can something like this even be written? I mean, the fact that a parent will lose total control of the care of their child because the state will take over, you know, like they'll give vaccinations in school when the parents aren't there to supervise. I mean, all kinds of things like that could happen. So how could even, who the heck is writing such a thing?
Well, and I don't know the answer, of course, but it raises a very disturbing prospect, and that is this, that someone can draft a law, convince a senator or representative to introduce it and get it into the lawmaking process. And if the law is unconstitutional, that in and of itself obviously does not mean that it gets rejected right at the beginning, as it should, in my opinion. The way that laws get passed is specific procedure is going to vary from state to state. There may be some states that have proposed laws go through a scrutiny process for constitutionality. And if there isn't, there ought to be in every state. A law like this should not even get into a committee for their consideration. But
it's a waste of time. It's a waste of the congressional representatives' time to even have to sit and read through something if at the outset, at the very start of the bill, it has stuff that is not constitutional that takes away our rights in this manner.
And I couldn't agree with you more, but apparently the reality is that that doesn't happen. And so it boils down to this. If we don't fight these effectively, unconstitutional laws can get on the books. And when a law is passed, and we have to understand, I have to clarify what we mean when we say something is unconstitutional. If a law is passed, that law is enforceable unless and until it is formally challenged in court and a court declares it to be unconstitutional. So, you know, for every, and this makes sense when you think about it, for every law that you and I might look at and say, gee, that's unconstitutional, there's going to be somebody else who says, oh, no, it isn't. And, or potentially there could be. So this goes to a broader concern. Don't let me get too far off track here, Debbie, but a broader concern that a lot of people talk very kind of freely about their constitutional rights, about this, that, or the other. And it's really important for us in two ways to make distinctions. One, between what we think our rights should be versus what they really are. And a lot of us don't understand that distinction. And the other that I just said with regard to a law, that once a law is passed, it is deemed to be constitutional and enforceable and valid unless and until it's formally challenged and that gets changed or the legislature revises it or what have you. But once it's out there with the books, it's potentially enforceable. Now, there are instances where laws are recognized as being unconstitutional and so they just aren't even fully enforced. There's a law in, I think it's Iowa, the religious exemption law requires membership in an organized religion, but the State Department of Health there has a form that doesn't ask you what your religion is. So they are not, the health department is not fully enforcing that statute. I would speculate because they probably know that if it were challenged in court, it would be deemed to be unconstitutional, so they're just going to only enforce it to the extent.
So what has been your part? I mean, not everyone knows every single piece of legislation that is being proposed, every bill that is being put forth to the legislature. How do people learn and find out about it? Or they probably have to get into a network or a community that gives them bulletins, because otherwise they're not even going to know that they can take action to prevent something from being passed.
Well, there's a lot of answers to that. I think the single best answer is the National Vaccine Information Center's advocacy portal. If you go to NVIC NVIC.org. That's the NVIC's acronym for National Vaccine Information Center, NVIC.org. One of their first few links on their homepage is their advocacy portal. The advocacy portal is a system set up by Don Richardson in Texas, who's been working with the NVIC for a period of years now. She and her husband have put together this marvelous system. This is the internet infrastructure for vaccine rights reform, and I can't praise the concept and highly enough, because I believe they've created a system here that will enable us to get a lot done that would have been much more difficult to get done. But they are seeking to have directors for every state. I don't know how many they have at this point, probably one or two dozen. They're looking to get directors for every state, but some of the directors are actually monitoring more than one state, which is wonderful, and are posting legislation. Now, I can't guarantee that the NVIC advocacy portal has everything that's going on in every state. They probably don't, but they are an excellent first step. Now, anybody can log on to their own state's website and do a search for bills, current bills, and use the word vaccine or immunization, probably best to try both, and see if any bills come up and see what they, you know, what's going on pertaining to vaccines or immunizations. But
well, tell us what your part is, because obviously I keep getting notices from you about bills that are coming up in different states. Even though you live in North Carolina, you are assisting, you get calls all the time from other people in other states to give them advice on how to respond to these papers that come up.
I have worked with people in several states around the country, and it's usually by request. Occasionally something comes to my attention and I feel compelled to pitch in and help, and I do. There's just very few attorneys in the country who focus on this area of law, vaccine rights, as it pertains to exemption and waiver-related issues. And but when I find out about these, I look for them. And I think it's important, as I said, we may or may not be able to get the grassroots effort to win, but if a bill is clearly raising constitutional questions, at least in theory, you could bring that to the attention of one legislator. If you do that effectively, that could be all it takes to kill the bill in its tracks. Now, we don't rely on that. You know, I say use a combination of all the strategies we have. But the point is this: raising constitutionality issues is not something that requires a majority of people to be behind for it to kill a bill. If there are serious constitutional issues, mm-hmm. and those involved with the question of whether or not to pass it are aware of that, they would be in serious neglect of their duties if they passed it anyway. I can't.
So
never...
it's sort of like it can't have a, even if it's not a unanimous vote, or if there's one thing that's out of place, then that can kill the bill from becoming law. Is that what you're telling us?
I'll tell you the picture that comes to mind, and perhaps it's a crude analogy, but you can have a couple of dozen people beating an elephant with sticks, and if they beat it hard enough and long enough, or if you get enough of them doing it, you'll bring the elephant down. But if you give it one good shot with an elephant gun between the eyes, that'll bring it down right away. And I think the constitutional issues, if there are serious constitutionality issues, has the potential to be the elephant gun. I'm not real happy with that uh-huh. analogy, but hopefully
no,
it
works. No, I'm not thrilled with it myself. You're going to have to think of something a little
I'll
bit.
I'll try to come up with a better one. I don't like that one. I actually love elephants, and I just felt really bad saying that. But the point
I would rather say the rotten apple in the barrel could spoil the whole lot.
Okay, let's do that. But here's the point, that sometimes having numbers is, you know, having a majority, having enough people contacting their representatives is enough.
So we do need to call.
But I question that whether or not the alternative vaccine movement is able to do that, at least on a consistent basis, at a level that it would override a bill that had the support of state health people, for example, and the medical community on a medical issue. And
it's a matter of consistency and perseverance and all of these forms of energy that, you know, you can't let your guard down. You have to constantly be there because things can get sneak, you know, they can sneak something through without your, if you're not looking.
And they try, and they'll try over and over again, you know. And that's
right.
From the point of view of trying to expand vaccine rights, what we're talking about in this particular bill is trying to prevent the diminishing of rights. But if you have a bill such as a trying to introduce, say, a philosophical exemption, I'm sorry, I just lost my point with that.
Philosophical exemption, you were saying.
Right,
yeah,
right.
I wanted to really talk about that. If a percentage of parents, even if they're very small, are legally exempt from routine immunizations due to religious objections, is that something that would come into play with this bill in New York, which is going to say, the people who are new and haven't heard this, it says a healthcare practitioner may provide healthcare related to the prevention of a sexually transmissible disease, including administering vaccines, to a person under the age of 18 years without the consent or knowledge of the parents or guardians of such person, provided that the person has capacity to consent to the care, without regard to the person's age and the person consents. So it's really highly explosive language in my point of view that somebody could propose such a thing that a parent or guardian would not know. And when they say sexually transmissible disease, that could be a broad range of, you know, hepatitis, you know, gonorrhea, syphilis. It could be anything. And for them to take power over you, it's very frightening.
Well, it raises several issues. And yes, if, for example, as you started to bring up, if the parents are exercising a vaccine religious exemption, and a minor's religious beliefs for legal purposes are deemed to be the beliefs of the parents. And so if either one of the parents is exercising a vaccine exemption on behalf of the child, then for any healthcare person to give a vaccine to that child without the parents' consent is going to be a violation of their federal First Amendment rights, a very blatant one, frankly.
But it's too late if they've been vaccinated. If they've been vaccinated, it's too late to, you know, to unvaccinate them. You can't do that.
You have to ask right off the bat, why would they want to vaccinate without the parents' consent? The only time that health care could be administered legally to a minor without the parents' consent, it would have to be an emergency situation where there medically was just not time to contact a parent. You had to do something immediately to save the child's life or to prevent serious permanent injury. That's the kind of thing where our legal system generally tolerates that sort of intervention.
Something like a swine flu epidemic. But when you're talking about a sexually transmissible disease, this is not the same type of a thing. At all.
Well, I would say not even a swine flu epidemic if it's along the lines of anything we had. If there was a terrorist attack with a biological weapon that created an immediate risk of harm, I mean if you go outside, you're exposed.
Like anthrax or something like that.
Right, and the child's in the doctor's office already and can't go home you know, without being exposed, and you just happen to have, you know, the vaccine there, assuming vaccines work and all that. You know, that's a situation, but that's not at all realistically possible. I mean,
that's a lot of assumptions.
I can't say it's not possible. It's you know, infinitesimally small chance that a child's going to be already in front of a doctor in that scenario without a parent there in the first place. But when you're concerned with vaccinating for STDs, you're talking about routine immunizations. You're not talking about an emergency situation where you have to vaccinate the child or the child's going to die before you can pick up the phone and call the parent. It's just not going to happen. If a child's in a serious car accident, they're bleeding to death, and you take them in and you've got to give them blood, and maybe that violates the parent's religious beliefs, the state probably has authority to do that or to enact laws giving doctors authority to do that. And most of us probably would hope that the doctor would take steps to save the child's life, even recognizing that it's going to be emotionally traumatic for the parents because it violates their religious beliefs, if indeed that's the case. But that's the kind of scenario where you can have a legitimate, you know, interest and concern, not for a routine immunization. So it really just doesn't pass the common sense test, as evidenced by your own initial reaction. But on the constitutional level, there's at least three different issues here, and the first one being what we talked about. If there's a religious exemption involved, the child may not know the parents' religious beliefs. The child may know the parents' religious beliefs and disagree with the parents, but the child still legally has the parents' religious beliefs. And so a child could deliberately opt not to say, even if a doctor asked, do your parents have any religious objections? That's not likely to happen. The bill doesn't require that.
Mm-hmm.
And most doctors are just not going to have the presence of mind and awareness of the issue to ask the question or feel the need to, even if they do.
Right. So that, there's not a process for making this more giving people their individual rights in this bill. In other words, it's not telling them that they must ask the child first, or they must, maybe they should have.
Well, they're saying the child has to have capacity to consent for the care. They're not just defining that, which is a separate issue we'll get to in a little bit.
Right.
But a child could be perfectly coherent, mature for his or her age, and could decide, my parents are nuts because they're exercising a vaccine religious exemption. The doctor says, I need this vaccine, I'm going to get it. And the child could say, okay, yeah, I'm fine, I understand this, I want the vaccine. You're still violating the parents' First Amendment rights if that's a minor child. So it's a setup for constitutional violations. Now, it's a setup for all kinds of other things medically, but that we can't really attack successfully, aren't likely to be able to attack. So this is another reason why I, whenever I see the opportunity, I take the constitutional approach, because that bypasses the whole question about whether the vaccines are safe and effective, should we be doing them. Now, there are surely are arguments on that level as well. The problem with those arguments at this point in time is that for every alternative doctor who says, you know, yes, the vaccines aren't safe, or there's better ways to deal with this, there are, you know, 10 or 100 or 1,000 other doctors and state and federal agency authorities are going to say, no, the vaccines are safe enough, we need to go ahead and use them. So it's just really hard to win that one at this point. Should we give that up? Absolutely not. We ultimately need to push forward with the truth about the science concerning vaccines. But in the short term, if there's a constitutional argument, that's often your strongest tactical piece. Should it be the only one? Absolutely not. Let's use everything we've got, but make sure we include this one. So it violates First Amendment beliefs. There are two other constitutional concerns, and just the idea that the state would consider giving healthcare practitioners authority to override a parent's fundamental constitutional parental right to parent their child is disturbing. We do have Supreme Court precedent that has said, in effect, that where parents are not, unless there's a showing that a parent is in some way incompetent or lacks the ability to care for their child, there's a constitutional presumption that parents will make decisions that are in the best interests of their children. By giving the authority about whether to vaccinate to a doctor, you are assuming that the parent is not able to make a decision in the best interest of their child. I mean, the only reason I can see for taking that decision away from a parent in a non-emergency situation is because you don't want to take the chance that the parent will disagree with you, so let's just make sure we do it the way we want to, whether the parent likes it or not. And that just flies in the face of our fundamental right as parents to parent our children. Now, in those exceptions
the bill that's being proposed is not an emergency situation. It is just it's going to be like a day-to-day type of imposition in the healthcare program.
It makes no reference to a context such as emergency context, which is a special context. It just
special
says,
case
may provide health care. just, you know, it's a very generalized language. So there's no limitation of this to, and I'm not really sure I can conceive of an emergency situation where a healthcare practitioner would ever need to vaccinate for a sexually transmissible disease on the basis of it being an emergency. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's not something you could get exposed to because it's in the air.
Right.
You know, so there's, you're not going to have a local outbreak that you need to send the unvaccinated kids home for a sexually transmissible disease. It's not contagious in the same way that chickenpox and measles and mumps are.
Right. It's the behavior of the, it would be the behavior of the child.
Well, and that's another you know, disturbing issue about this, because this is not about contagiousness in the typical sense. It's about behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And for a lot of people, those are moral or even legal issues and not something that government should be intervening in any sort of mandatory sort of sense. Should our state governments be concerned about sexually transmissible diseases? Of course. You know, there mm-hmm. are sometimes serious problems with that. Should they be mandating vaccines for a disease related to behavior that is necessarily intertwined with people's fundamental religious beliefs in at least some instances? Absolutely. I mean, absolutely we should be very concerned about that and look at that much more closely. But I don't think we even get to that level here because of the more blatant and broadly recognized concerns. So we've got the religious concern. We've got parents' fundamental right to parent their children absent some kind of showing that the parent is unfit to do that. And so the presumption is that parents are able to make decisions in the best interest of their children, and that they will make decisions in the best interest of their children. And it's not until you rebut that presumption, till you show in a formal legal way that a parent is unfit, that you can then start limiting the unfit parent's rights to parent their child. What this law does is jump right past all of that, in effect, making an assumption that all parents are unfit to make a decision in the best interest of their child regarding sexually transmissible diseases and corresponding vaccines.
Rather than taking it on a case-by-case basis. Now, what about the 14th Amendment? What does that state, and how does that apply here?
Well, part of the 14th Amendment is the Equal Protection Clause. And in general, what that does is require states to apply laws evenly and consistently. So if this bill were enacted into law, it raises many questions. Would there be a clear standard for how to determine whether or not a minor has capacity? This paragraph in the law refers to if the child has capacity to consent, the child can make the decision. I mean, first of all, a child and an adult are not on an equal playing field, so whatever the adult wants is likely what's going to come out when you have an adult-child interaction, whether or not there's any sort of ill-intended attempt to manipulate. It's not an equal playing field. So to say that a child has capacity, what does that mean? I don't think you can refer to capacity, however strictly you define that, as being something that puts the child in a position to be on a level playing field with a healthcare practitioner to make a decision about the issue. But let's assume for the sake of discussion that, you know, some middle-aged teenagers, middle to upper teens, you know, would have the maturity and ability to make an intelligent decision about this. And many of them perhaps could. How are we going to define capacity? And is that going to be clearly defined for this specific purpose? Will there be any sort of training provided or required for those people who are going to be making that assessment? And if so, is that going to be at taxpayers' expense? And who's going to put all that together? And will only persons with training or expertise in, say, child psychology be making those kinds of determinations or deciding what defines that? And here's the test, here's what you have to do to find out if the child has capacity in this particular situation.
It sounds like the entire thing is over time a very long and involved process to make all of these decisions and understandings about the parent's mental capacity to be able to take care of the child's capacity to be able to handle such these types of questions. I mean, it's not something that would happen immediately in an hour. It would be a very long and involved process to find out the answers to all these questions.
Well, and here's my point and how it relates back to the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause, and it boils down to this. Without some real in-depth work to define that term, to determine how to get that definition and a process for assessing capacity out to everyone who's in a position to potentially be assessing capacity, without that kind of extensive effort, I believe that the application of this law would be very inconsistent throughout the state, that you will have situations where that what will inevitably occur, there'll be situations where similar kids in similar settings and similar situations are going to get treated differently, that some mm-hmm. will get a vaccine or some will not get a vaccine.
Right. So a child who stands up for their rights and says, you know, I really don't know the answer to this. I better ask my parent. Or a child who says, I don't want anything in my body. Or a child who says, hey, you're scaring the heck out of me. I better go ahead and do it. The outcome is going to be based on the kind of like I want to say the personality of the child, whether they're self-confident enough, whether they know enough about their body, whether they're conscious of health care and how to take care of themselves. You know, these types of things, I think that's going to determine what the outcome of a law like this, how it will apply in the actual community or where it's being implemented, will be based on the ability of the child to be vocal, to be communicative, to be able to know the information beforehand. And this almost kind of sounds like those who are not educated are not going to really understand what's happening and will go ahead and say, yeah, I better do this because you are the one who knows best for me. So that kind of thing is what might happen as a scenario.
Well, I think even more so, though, determined by the doctor's personalities, because doctors, and I hate to generalize because there are exceptions everywhere, but in my experience and what I hear from clients over and over again, doctors tend to be coercive with regard to vaccines. And even if you have a child who's informed and even mildly assertive, if you have a doctor that is the doctor and an adult, and I know better than you because I have a medical degree, whether they're saying that in those words or just sort of carrying that whole persona, I'm the authority, you have to do what I say kind of thing. And you and I both know that that's going to happen in this kind of a setting. If a law like this gets passed, there's going to be a lot of kids immunized who probably don't want to be immunized. It's just like I hear this from adults, and I think it's even more so with children. I'll give you a quick example. I've heard from dozens of nurses and other hospital employees over the last several months who contact me and say the hospital, and this is happening all over the country, hospitals are implementing new requirements for healthcare employees, whether they have contact with patients or not, to get flu vaccines, and in some cases, vaccines in addition to flu vaccines. And for everyone that calls me and says, I'm willing to stand up for my rights, they say, but there's a bunch of other people in my department or other departments who don't want the vaccine either, but they're afraid to rock the boat, so they're not going to say anything, and they're just going to go ahead and get the vaccine. Individually, they can't afford to risk being let go, either because their attempt to get an exemption didn't work or they were just deemed to be troublemakers and let go. And so if that happens in the adult population, it's going to happen even more in the – now, those adults are responsible for themselves because they're adults. But my point is it's going to happen even more with minors who are even more easily intimidated by adults with credentials.
Right. So it could be a case of being intimidated also. So I'm going to open the line because Manfred, I think, has called in today. Manfred?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. I noticed that you called in, but I couldn't identify your line. So thank you for joining us. We have been talking about this bill, this New York bill that's being proposed which we have a lot of questions about its constitutionality and how it will be applied in reality on the ground, in communities, in schools, wherever it would be. Do you have remarks?
I've been following the fascinating conversation you've had. It immediately reminded me of a similar situation when the hepatitis B bill was, the hepatitis B vaccine was introduced, and it seemed like there was very little reason to mandate a vaccine that only a very small, tiny percentage of the population would run a risk of getting that disease, especially children. Currently, I think in North Carolina, it's mandated to be given at birth, and of course, this is another special situation where we have a vaccine where the child would not have any say-so in this case. One wonders how these decisions are made. I understand the hepatitis B epidemic was at that time was used as an argument why we needed this vaccine. It involved a total of 5 teenage children, if I remember correctly, that happened here in North Carolina, in New Bern, North Carolina. There was a small number of teenagers who had shared needles, heroin needles, and one of the children had hepatitis B and passed it on to another child, maybe to 2 or 3 more other children.
Right,
and
so
that's
those
why
were
the entire country, everyone, now has to have a hepatitis B shot at birth. My question is, are these medical decisions, do they make any sense? Are they really economic decisions? Because some manufacturer would like to produce a vaccine, and then they go through the political channels, and they try to convince politicians to adopt these measures. And now, they have a secure, guaranteed market where they can load off these vaccines. That's more of a concern to me.
Right.
Go
ahead.
Greetings, Manfred. Pleasure to have you on. There's an
Thank
underlying.
You. Likewise.
Thanks. There's an underlying fundamental concern just in the structure of our political system, where anytime you have a conflict between health and profit. The inevitable outcome of that apparently is the sort of thing we see where we have this, for example, as I'm sure you well know, Manfred, this revolving door between federal agencies and the pharmaceutical industry. Just a little over a year ago, the head of the CDC announced her job change from CDC director to president of Merck Vaccines. When there's the prospect for somebody in a federal agency, and I'm sure this exists at state agency level as well, for them to get lucrative jobs in the industry, how can they possibly be, even with the best of intentions, objective in the policies that they promote and support and enact? It's so clearly there are some blatant conflicts of interest, but there is such an effective fear campaign connected with and associated with vaccines and disease that it's it's hard to overcome that, I think, or at least that seems to be the case. I think we are gradually moving in the right direction. I'm cautiously encouraged, but historically and so far, people's concern on a fear level about disease seems to be driving policy more so, or at least the support for policy that comes from the public, more so than any sort of true understanding of the information relevant to decisions. And so the population tends to either support or allow laws and policy that, when scrutinized, just really don't hold water.
Yes, but in the case of the hepatitis B vaccine, who challenges these things? Because, first of all, the decision was a false decision from the very beginning from a public health point of view. What can we do once these decisions have been made? Like, for example, in North Carolina, I'm sure somebody on some committee makes these decisions, and now we're stuck with that vaccine, and everybody has to have it. Is there ever any is there a process to undo these decisions? Other words, after 18 years or so of hepatitis B vaccine, it's pretty much been shown there's no evidence that there is any hepatitis B epidemics, certainly not in children of infant and toddler age.
Well, the rationale that I've heard, not that I personally agree with it, but for vaccinating children at birth with hepatitis B, and I'll just say as a quick aside, the idea of vaccinating anyone at birth for anything is just so appalling to me, I can't understand it. But was because, well, it'll be a lot harder to get these kids in for a vaccine when they're teenagers, when they're at the point where they're going to be at risk. You know, I have to joke to keep from crying about the hepatitis B vaccine, because we all know how newborns are sexually promiscuous and get a hold of needles for the drugs they do. It's just absurd. But the rationale used again was that, well, it's hard to get these kids as teenagers, but almost all children are born in a hospital, so we can get them right then and there. Let's do it. But it doesn't even make sense from a mainstream point of view, because I'm not even sure the vaccine's effect, that perhaps it wears off by the time the kids get, assuming vaccines even work, which is a whole separate issue. But let's assume for the moment, but here's my point, even from the mainstream point of view, we assume the vaccine works, but doesn't its effects wear off by the time the newborn is of an age where they would be potentially sexually promiscuous or involved with drugs? And what percentage of them actually fall into that category anyway?
They're asking for boosters. Well, you know what it is? It's the mentality of fear that pervades the United States. If one person can have a shoe bomb, and now the rest of the world has to take off their shoes forever when they go to the airport for one incident, you can see. And when will that be stopped? When will we say that's not doing anything, and take that parameter back from everybody having to do it. So in the same way, so we need to have legislative action that we can reevaluate these laws that are on the books.
And
I was going to say also is not taking drugs or shooting up heroin, is that not a criminal activity? Are we not requiring the law-abiding citizens to be punished in a way for the behavior of criminals.
To the extent that we're paying for the vaccines, I would say yes.
Yeah, it's like a presumed guilty until proven innocent. And in this situation, what can we do? What avenues do we have legally to reverse decisions like this?
Right, and so that brings us to a really fundamental point for me with this whole larger vaccine issue and arena, and that is that where the rubber meets the road is in the laws that are on the books or not on the books. And so we as a society, I think, are largely really passive with regard to our legislative issues, with regard to our participation or lack of participation in the legislative arena, and yet it's the fundamental place where the rules are made. So we need to become legislatively active. We need to be meeting with state representatives, educating them on our concerns, and asking them to amend laws or enact new laws that are more rational and sane, that are not based on profiting the pharmaceutical industry at the expense of the health and well-being of society, but rather are really taking an honest, hard look at what really is the need or lack of need for this vaccine in this situation, or what really is the effectiveness, what really are the adverse events, which I assert we don't know, and just that alone. We know that vaccines do cause death and disability. We really don't know the extent of that, and that fact alone, as far as I'm concerned, is a basis for why our government should not be mandating vaccines for anybody. So it's an educational process. We have a huge emotional fear barrier, I think, to get past. But Manfred is a terrific person to be in touch with and in contact with. I really have to commend you, Manfred, on your ability to articulate the issues and concerns associated with vaccines or perhaps anything in legislative issues. You know, we have a bill pending here in North Carolina right now that wants to make the practice of medicine without a license a felony, whereas currently it's only a misdemeanor. And I had been asking around, you know, my initial gut reaction to that was, this is an attack on alternative health care. And I got Manfred's email, and I saw that he had very articulately explained and assessed and analyzed the issue. And this is the guy that I want helping me out when I'm working on legislative issues, I'll tell you that.
Thanks.
Do you have particular points that you would like to mention regarding that bill and going up to the North Carolina legislature?
Well, I would like to say one thing, which I said in my email that I sent out to a bunch of people, quite a large list of people, as a matter of fact, and that is, you know, if we need a bill like this, you know, if there are people out there who pretend to be doctors, in other words, they wear a white coat and they hire on to major medical centers and collect a high salary, even though they have no medication, I could see, first of all, that yes, maybe we need to be these people need to be punished in some way, but the fact is there are very few such people, if any, and even so, I think our current tort laws have ample powers to deal with a situation like that. I'm sure they would be in prison for doing that. Impersonating a doctor, but that's not really why these bills are being introduced. They've been introduced several times now, and every time they were defeated. In fact, in 2000, many of my clients and many other alternative practitioners' clients were showed up at the Raleigh at the legislature, maybe over 100 people. Of course, by the time they were ready to hear them, I think the legislative liaison of the North Carolina Medical Society had already withdrawn the bill because they recognized there was tremendous opposition. Why do they keep introducing this? Well, it's because there is, on a national level, there is an effort to reduce access and to reduce provision of alternative health care services. And that is, again, one of those monopolistic activities that the American Medical Association has been guilty of, as was found out during the trial by the Chiropractic Association, a National Chiropractors Against the American Medical Association, that there was a group that was active, and I think these groups are still active, to try to reduce the number of alternative practitioners in this country. And many of these techniques they use are kind of underhanded. They're not right out in the open because they know alternative practitioners are popular and people want access to alternative medicine. But, of course, they will try to do their best to reduce access, and this is one of the ways they do it. So you put out a bill. Alternative practitioners are an easy target. You put out a bill that says practicing medicine without a license is a felony. Well, when you look at what's defined as the practice of medicine, you can give your neighbor, recommend that your neighbor take a vitamin C for their cold. That's the practice of medicine, according to North Carolina law.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really a bill that's targeted to diminish, to make it more difficult for alternative practitioners. Now, alternative practitioners are professionals. Most of them are trained. Most of them have certification in their fields. And most of the alternative healthcare professions are professions of common right. That means these folks have the right to practice their occupation, to engage in their occupation, unless, of course, they do something illegal. And, of course, that is what they're trying to do. They're trying to make it very, very illegal to do anything resembling the practice of medicine.
Right. To have a monopoly by the physicians on any kind of health care where they don't even have the knowledge about proper nutrition and diet and really well-being to impart to their patients to prevent illness.
Yes.
So, it's another
so homeopaths, for example, they have training in homeopathy. Many of them are certified in homeopathy, and yet and there's no harm from the profession of homeopathy, and they work very well in conjunction with conventional medicine. I know that people can go to conventional physicians, and they can choose to supplement that treatment with another form of treatment. That's what people want. And these laws, they pretend to protect the public against somebody. But who are they protecting the public against? Against the people that people actually want to see. So,
and they are seeing them.
Seeing them. That's right.
Yes.
So alternative practitioners often have to kind of practice in a semi a public way, privately, and that's just not acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like these laws, they're antiquated. First of all, if that's how they want to continue to proceed, I think. Then I think the public is going to eventually respond, and we already have responded. In many states, we see health freedom movements, which also ties in with some of the discussions we had earlier about vaccines. People no longer want the state to make decisions about their private lives and their bodies. And there's a strong movement against that nationwide. And I think it's the right thing, because people are more educated now. They don't need medical doctors to make decisions for them, and they don't want medical doctors to make decisions for them. It's simply no longer appropriate.
Well, I would like to say that the first hour has ended regarding the legalities of health freedom, constitutional law, all of the advocacy work that Alan Phillips is doing, and helping to educate and support the other people in all the states for the national vaccine information and exemptions and all the things that he is doing out there on radio shows, talk shows, conferences, his written affidavits and everything else. We want to thank him so much. I know he has to get to court and do some other things today. We're going to continue the show with Manfred and a new topic, which is the reverse chronological tautopathy, which I think I've got that tongue twister down.
Yes. And thanks, Alan. Are you still there?
I really appreciate
your work.
Well, thank you, and yours as well. I'll try to listen in on a recording of this later. I'm sorry to have to skip out on the live version of it, but...
good luck with the court hearing.
Well, appreciate it. We'll be back next Thursday at 12 noon, and perhaps we'll get into the New Jersey bill again, because that one has, again, reared its ugly head. And terrific.
Okay.
Listeners, stick around. You're not going to want to miss this next hour. Take care.
Yes.
Thank you, Alan. Okay, I guess we're just going to transition right into the next area of work. I'll introduce Manfred one more time for those folks who don't know who he is. Manfred Mueller has developed this comprehensive approach to homeopathic treatment for the adverse effects of past infections, vaccinations, drugs, toxins, and occupational exposures. It is called reverse chronological tautopathy. He is a distinguished homeopathic practitioner and educator. What's the name of your school?
The Homeopathic College.
Homeopathic College in North Carolina. And he is an integrative medicine consultant for the program on integrative medicine at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine Memorial Hospital in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. I'm looking forward to speaking with you today regarding this protocol that you've been using. I have received and been listening to your tutorials, which are absolutely excellent. I highly recommend them. In the practice, you use multiple strategies that integrate current scientific insight into homeopathic methodology without sacrificing the classical principles. And that's important, because many homeopaths are very limited and confined to doing it only in the classical method. And Manfred, you demonstrate daily with your consistent, excellent clinical results with patients, and you do that, you show the results in live clinics.
Mm-hmm.
Homeopathy is a viable treatment for people with complex chronic disorders, and you do list cancer as one of those disorders. I suppose, to eliminate the effects of traditional treatment, which can be kind of debilitating and fatiguing. With our mental capacity, I know as a survivor that chemotherapy and radiation can have some adverse effects. So I'm going to go ahead and ask you to kind of give us a baseline on what is reverse chronological tautopathy.
Well, I did want to make a quick correction to something you said. I don't treat people for any of those conditions, and I do provide people with information on how to do this themselves. And so let's talk about the reverse chronological tautopathy method. This is a method that can be employed in conjunction with and as part of ordinary homeopathic treatment. Homeopathic treatment uses the symptoms of a person who is sick, the whole syndrome associated with a sickness, as guidelines to find a suitable medicine. Obviously, that's a very simple, straightforward approach to healthcare. However, in many cases today, people have very complex chronic disorders. And they're not just suffering from natural sicknesses as they had in the 19th century when homeopathy was developed, and a lot of the methodology in homeopathy was developed in the 19th century, where people would have infections, and some of those infections led to chronic disorders. As an example, we could use gonorrhea. Gonorrhea, if left untreated, it would go through a latent phase and eventually serious chronic problems would show up that could be traced back to that original gonorrhea infection. And this is also true with syphilis. So today, this is rather uncommon, although it still does happen. A lot of today's chronic disorders are associated with multiple exposures, and some of those exposures include medication, suppressive medication, to try in an attempt to stop the symptoms associated with those disorders. So when you look at a patient's history, you find that you have a lot of multiple complex issues that develop over time. And each of those, you could say, represents a disorder of its own, or you could say a layer of the complex chronic disorder over time. So when you look at what people are suffering from over time, you see, the disorder may start out as a very simple problem. Let's say dysmenorrhea, which is a often hormonal imbalance and causing trouble during menstruation. And let's say the doctor prescribes a hormone, like, say, estrogen, for that disorder. Then that estrogen may have some effects. Maybe it will regulate the period somewhat and maybe even alleviate some of the symptoms. But in addition to that, it induces a disorder of its own because the body responds to and adapts to the presence of hormonal drugs. This is also true, by the way, with hormone replacement therapy.
Right. And doctors are aware of this, true with all medication.
And this is called the secondary effect of drugs. The primary effect of the drug is the therapeutic effect. In other words, in a blood pressure medication, you want to lower the blood pressure. The blood pressure medication does lower the blood pressure, usually, in most cases, if it's effective, if it's the proper medication. However, in addition to that, there's a secondary effect on the organism adapting to the medication. So In a nutshell, we could say that treatment through controlling symptoms or suppressing symptoms produces a chronic kind of secondary disorder. And based on that recognition, to really reverse complex chronic disorders nowadays, it would be necessary to remove these secondary effects. And historically, that has been possible in homeopathy.
Doctors recognize this, do they not?
The effects of the medication, but also of the toxins or the vaccinations, simply antidoting those effects sometimes would undo that chronic disorder.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how is that done? It is done by producing a homeopathic medication from the medication, from the poison, and from the vaccine.
Okay.
Okay. Are we still there?
Manfred, yes, I am.
Hello?
I was trying to, yes. Can you hear me? Maybe he can't hear me, and that's why. Sounds like he's not able to hear me. Manfred, are you there? Okay, I hear you fine, but obviously you're not hearing me.
Debbie?
Yes, I am here.
What happened?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. I must have had a problem with the phone.
Yeah, you did have a big problem because I was trying to talk to you and you were not getting a message through. Okay, I'm glad.
How far did we get?
How far could
you hear me?
I heard you all the way up into the end, but I had some kind of questions during that period, and I guess you didn't hear me.
What
I was asking was that the physicians today actually recognize these secondary effects, and that's why they have lowered the dosages of estrogen and progesterone over the last 10 years. It was much higher. And so because they've recognized that they are aware of these toxic effects, as what would affect breast effects, and you're dealing with your protocol.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that's good to know. I am aware that there has been changes, for example, in how hormone replacement therapy is administered. And I guess
Go ahead.
One of the ways that is done is, like you said, by reducing the dose and try to avoid those. But the thing is, those effects still occur.
Even with the lower dosages.
That's correct.
Right. And homeopathy is aware of that, and we utilize mm-hmm. that information.
Correct. So what else did you ask me that I didn't hear?
That was really it. I thought as you were speaking, you were talking about the treatment through controlling the symptoms or suppressing the symptoms produces this chronic disorder that people know is happening to them, and they kind of make it in. They kind of disregard it. They say, "Well, it's just getting older," or "This is just part of the way I am now." And it's something that becomes so familiar to their being that sometimes they just don't do anything about it, or don't raise any to that. Is that something that you might have noticed in your practice?
Oh, absolutely. That's what people report who are, especially those people who have been on medication for years for some chronic condition, or even more so when there are multiple chronic conditions that are diagnosed that have developed over time. When they do develop new conditions, often, but the even more serious problem is they will simply be diagnosed with a new condition, and then they get medication for the new condition. So people who are in multiple medications are often on medications because of treatment for previous conditions that were also medication-induced conditions, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the problem.
Okay, go ahead. Yeah,
now,
the problem is they're redefining what it is, or they're giving a new label to a disease, which is actually an effect of the drug.
Yes.
And
It's a side effect, and usually that's the term that conventional medicine uses for this. It's a side effect of the drug.
Right. We have somebody on the chat who is asking a question about any experience with reflex sympathetic dystrophy. She calls it RSD complex, and not familiar with it. Maybe you have heard of it.
I have not, but I'd be happy to look into it.
Okay, so we'll have to find out exactly what that is.
Yes.
Regional pain syndrome, she calls it.
Yes, I am familiar with regional pain syndrome. And there's a lot of different names and some considerable controversy over the cause of this.
Okay, so this is not fibromyalgia.
No, it is not, apparently. It does something of a damage, perhaps, to the nerve, but really there's a lot of controversy about this syndrome.
Okay. And have you actually seen any?
I've talked to several people about it, and in some cases it seemed to be centered around the wrist and forearm and the entire arm in some cases, and sometimes wandering over the whole body.
Oh, she says it's something else. So maybe she needs to... please define what it is.
Okay, perhaps can you tell us perhaps more about it?
Okay, so we're going to ask her to do that on the chat.
Mm-hmm.
She says it's a progressive neurological condition.
Right.
So is this, so we're still not sure exactly what it is.
Right.
Maybe she'll give us some more. But let's continue on with the... explanation of your protocol for the reverse chronological tautopathy. And
yes.
Let's see, we were going to find out.
Well, we're talking about the side effects of medications producing,
right.
You know, side effects are simply just the effects of the medication. So when you go to an expert dictionary or record index of medications, like you can do this on the web. RxList is an example at drug.com. They will list the side effects of medications, and many of them are rather vague and sound rather unimportant, like nausea, indigestion, insomnia, and so forth. But when you look at a more thorough list, then you find entire disorders listed. In fact, the company that publishes the physician's desk reference used to publish a kind of reverse dictionary that listed conditions and then would list the drugs that could induce that condition. And this is still possible on the computer when you have that, the reference from the physician's desk reference. But it's very sketchy, and I've always found it very difficult to use. When I looked at it, I found that conditions are listed on multiple places in different names, so as to reduce the number of drugs that are associated with that condition. In a way, a kind of trick. So you would have, liver cancer, listed in five different locations, like it would be listed under hepatic carcinoma, then it would be listed on liver cancer, then it would be tumor of the liver, and so on. It'd be a kind of attempt to try to reduce the number of medications that would be listed under liver cancer. And, of course, that is not a good way to do that, because why should you have to look in multiple different locations for really the same condition? Liver cancer can be produced by many different medications. There are many other conditions listed in that index, and so medicine has some knowledge, but it's sort of rather obscure. It's not out in the open. In fact, there are numerous conditions produced by medications. And that is important. We should be aware of this. And a reverse chronological tautopathy is an approach that can systematically reverse some of these conditions that are induced by progressive medications and drug-induced or medication-induced diseases or disorders. mm-hmm. and that then lead to additional disorders.
Okay. So now we have a little bit more information from the chat room regarding that condition, and maybe this can help us understand the process that you use. She says that it is a sympathetic nervous system which is damaged, and the flight and fight response in the brain is triggered.
Yeah, I've heard about that before. No, I have no experience with it.
And let's see, it runs constantly. So the symptoms that people will experience are pain, swelling, lack of circulation. It can and does spread internally and externally. There's mental inability to find simple words. And so it really affects the brain function. The treatments are normally heavy narcotics, which cause more problems than they solve.
Yes.
And it ranks on the Gantt pain scale higher than bone cancer. And a new theory is evolving that the GLIA is activated. So this is and she also said that it occurs due to some sort of a surgery or a fall, which sounds like some kind of a trauma, and there's no real cure to this progressive neurological condition. So it sounds like there is an impact on the body, the mind, emotional systems of the individual, which it goes into this panic kind of condition, and it changes the brain function. I don't know. It sounds like a complex disease.
Yes.
And would have to be dealt with on a homeopathic methodology, both classical and potentially, if the person has had a lot of medications, using your treatment plan.
Yes.
Or which is the reverse chronological tautopathy. And
well,
so maybe
I'd love to look into this disorder, because this is exactly what I specialize. I do research on complex disorders, and especially new disorders, and often I discover ways to, when you understand the history, you could say the evolution of these disorders, sometimes you can discover ways to undo them.
Okay.
And in each case, this is experimental. Obviously, it'd be novel. One of the advantages of the homeopathic method is there's really no risk in using it. There's no adverse reactions directly from the homeopathic treatment or from the use of RCT.
Yes, that's one of the beauties of homeopathy, is that it has shown to be effective over the course of over 200 years. And with these new protocols, we're very flexible and we change to adapt to the new kinds of toxins that are out there. And I would consider constant medication to change the body system. So tell us more about the program.
Well, and one of the things that many homeopaths had seen, and going all the way back to the founder of homeopathy, is that the symptoms of the drug disorder that are induced by suppressive drugs are often opposite of the secondary disorder, I should say, produced by the drug, are often opposite to the initial original disorder. Which is, of course, logical, because the drug was used for that purpose. It was basically used for its ability to produce an opposite disorder. So this is very clear-cut in blood pressure medication. In blood pressure medicine, you would want to use a medication that can lower the blood pressure. Well, that is the drug disorder, we could say the drug effect.
Mm-hmm.
Except we don't put it into those terms in conventional medicine. You don't think of it as a disorder. But it is, in fact, a drug-induced disorder.
Well, we do in homeopathy, don't we call medicines artificial disease?
Yes, absolutely.
Kahneman calls it that.
Well, mm-hmm. in fact, that's what medicines are. So, for example, when you use an opiate for the control of pain, you induce the disorder of numbness. Or if you want to slow down the heartbeat with digoxin, for example, in the case of atrial fibrillation, you actually induce a slow heartbeat artificially. That is a disorder. But that is the primary effect of the drug. You could say it's the primary drug disorder. There's also a secondary drug disorder that is opposite of the primary effect. And that's my point. The secondary disorder is the body's adaptation to the drug. So in a way, each drug induces an unintended increase in the chronic, already existing chronic problem, which makes people then dependent on the drug. So suppressive approach to through medication to disease produces a dependency on medication. That's the important thing to realize.
So we're
just like taking heroin or cocaine or whatever, will produce a further need for that drug.
Right.
And it's a physiological need. It's not just psychological dependency we're talking here. We're talking about an adaptation that the organism undergoes as a result of the medication.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So how does homeopathy, or how does reverse chronological tautopathy, what is tautopathy first of all? Tautopathy is the use of a homeopathically potentized medication. Potentized, that means it goes through the same process of dilution and succussion, which is an attempt to turn a substance into its energetic equivalent, which means, we've discussed this before, I believe, on this program.
There may be new listeners.
Yes, that's true. In any case, the homeopathic medicine does not really contain any substance as it is used for the purpose of reverse chronological tautopathy. It undergoes through a process of dilution and succussion that's small steps, and ultimately the actual substance is so radically reduced that for all practical purposes there's nothing left. Although recent research has found there is maybe still some molecules left of the original substance.
Mm-hmm.
And in any case, both clinical observations over the last 200 years, as you've explained, have shown that these medicines can undo the effect of the original medication. And this is a subsection of homeopathy called tautopathy. Tautos is a Greek term and means the identical. And pathy is comes from pathos, which is suffering. So a drug which can induce the identical suffering can be used in potentized form to undo that suffering. And it's basically using the same drug that produced a disorder to undo that disorder in a different form. So that's essentially in a nutshell what tautopathy is. The other part is the reverse chronological, and that's important to see that the evolution of complex chronic disorders that are drug-induced or they're produced by external factors such as toxins, poisons in the environment, or even infections, and certainly vaccines, that those take place over time. So in other words, let's say you take a 2-year-old child or 18-month-old child receives their first or maybe even their second or third DPT shot and develops eczema after that shot. Now, how could that happen? Well, if folks who listen to your show, they're probably aware that there are certain substances in vaccines that could certainly induce in certain susceptible people eczema, such as thimerosal, traces of mercury, can produce eczema. So we have an eczema outbreak, and that, let's say this child doesn't overcome this, it becomes a chronic thing. So the typical treatment for that would be prednisone ointments and so forth, steroids over time, but that doesn't cure the eczema. It keeps coming back. So let's say you grow up with the eczema. This child now is an adult and still has eczema. So we now have a one drug-induced disorder, but because of the frequent use of prednisone ointment, we also have suppressed this child's immune system. Prednisone suppresses the immune system, even if it's used topically. And let's say this child has become susceptible to fungal infections, and now has a chronic fungal infection, and so on. And now we have a medication like a fungus antibiotic that we use.
Antifungal.
Chronically, antifungal medication.
Yeah.
And let's say this antifungal medication is capable of also producing another side effect, which is kind of a chronic allergy. So now we have developed chronic allergies. And, of course, all chronic illnesses are always an interplay between certain exciting causes and susceptibilities that already exist. And in homeopathy, we have the ability to undo by simply using the medicine for each drug-induced disorder made from that very drug, and undoing the effect of that medication. This is especially very dramatic in case of an acute drug effect. So, for example, if someone develops a skin rash after ingesting an antibiotic, that same antibiotic in potentized form very quickly will relieve the person of that skin rash.
Long term.
Pardon?
Long term. I mean,
well,
it,
even
it's not
in the
something.
Even in the short run,
mm-hmm.
if it's given right after, so it's similar to the way homeopathic medicines are used for in case of let's say an insect bite. Let's say you get stung by a wasp and use Apis mellifica. You can see quick relief from that, which is, of course, a very similar substance. Apis mellifica is made from the honeybee, crushed honeybee, and contains some of the venom, which is similar to the venom of the wasp. So,
Or you could use Vespa.
Yes, you could use Vespa, in which case you would use the same. And both both are capable of relieving in potentized form the effects of that bite, that sting.
So what you're saying is it can be used immediately after a drug as an acute to relieve symptoms, but it also can be used in a chronic condition to alleviate long-term symptoms.
That's correct.
Okay.
And, of course, if we look at a complex chronic disorder, we're looking at something that one disorder coming on top of another. And that is a chronological event. It's an evolution over time. So by using the homeopathic equivalent to the most recent drug first, and then following with the next drug and so on, after a careful study of the history of how this disorder developed over time, or you say the disorders, sometimes they're multiple diagnostic disorders. In other words, conventional physicians have made, let's say, 7-8 different disorders, and most of which are sustained by a medication. So these disorders can often be undone by the reverse chronological tautopathy method.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
What is the difference between tautopathy and isopathy? Because I usually think about that one.
Good question. Actually, it's a more or less a formal difference. Isopathy, the word isos or isos in Greek means the same in the sense of the same number of things. So isos is not really the correct term. Tautos means the identical, the same in terms of the identical thing. So tautos is actually the correct term. But isos was used historically for the use of a medication that was made from an outcome of a disorder, or you could say a discharge from a disease, such as you might have in a pus-forming condition. They would use the pus and make a homeopathic potentized remedy from it. And that would then be called a nosode. It was actually presumed to also be causing the disease, because they were thinking, well, this is obviously an organism that's caused this disease. So they thought it was the same thing, but actually it is simply the effect of the disease, or you could say a product of the disease, rather than the cause of the disease. Strictly speaking, if you would like to reverse the cause by using the substance that produced the disease, you are actually employing tautopathy, not isopathy. But in multiple language usage, this term has often been interchanged, so people are no longer aware of the difference.
Okay, that's excellent. So you're saying actually when we talk about using nosodes, we're actually using isopathy. But when we're using the actual same identical product, then it is tautopathy.
That produced the disease, yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, so we're kind of understanding. Did you explain the difference between standard and classical homeopathy?
Not really, but some people might have that question. You know, how does this differ from homeopathy, and why is this a different terminology? Well, obviously, homeopathy refers to using a product that is similar and not identical in terms of its symptoms to the suffering. So, for example, I use the example in the acute condition of a wasp bite. If you use an Apis, it's actually similar. Honeybee produces a similar condition as a wasp produces. And so by using a similar product, you can also get the effect. You don't necessarily have to have the same. But apparently the more similar it is, the better the effect. And sometimes the most similar, in homeopathy we call dissimilimum, which is Latin for the most similar, brings the best effects. And Hahnemann himself said at some point about isopathy in the use of a nosode, that is in fact the most similar if you use it in potentized form. So using
in a case that is similar to use the nosode for life.
Yes, the isopathic approach is the similimum to any condition. And this is in the last paragraph of the book Chronic Diseases before he goes into the Materia Medica section.
Okay. And can I ask how many people are using this tautopathy method? Are there a lot of people doing it?
Well, you know, the idea, the principle, has been used throughout history in forms of essentially to remove obstacles to cure. So homeopaths in the 19th century recognized some of the new medications they were using, like anesthesia was used at the turn of the century. J. Compton Burnett, a London homeopath, wrote a little booklet on a problem he encountered in treating people. He's a physician in London, and he would treat people who had surgery, and anesthesia was used. And then they came to the homeopath and were hoping to get cured by homeopathic treatment, and he found there was a problem afterwards. He saw the medicines were no longer effective. So he discovered that in those days we were using ether. So he potentized ether and first treated them with potentized ether. And after that, the regular medicine were effective. So he effectively removed with the means of a tautopathic remedy an obstacle to cure that was simply induced by the anesthetic.
Mm-hmm.
But I did not, and obviously this is done after, so chronologically, we are reversing something to bring them back to the state they were prior to the surgery, when the homeopathic medicine still worked. So he discovered that was the case, and he also used it in other medication, like aspirin was used in those days. So he used, we'd first remove the effect of the aspirin, and then he'd use medication. Later, Donald Fubister is his name, another British homeopath.
Fubister?
Yes, he refers to a similar method, and he also refers to it like the effect of salt, for example. He would use natrum muriaticum first, so that's again an example of a tautopathic medicine made from salt.
Mm-hmm.
And he felt like people suffer from the long-term secondary effect of salt, eating too much salt.
Right.
And so homeopaths traditionally have used this method, but it's not the reverse chronological method, which is a systematic method of addressing multiple obstacles, you could say, or addressing entire complex disorders that are purely poison-induced, drug-induced, vaccine-induced, etc. So, for example, if you had exposure to a pesticide, that is part of your chronic disorder, and then it's often not really possible to, in complex chronic disorders, to differentiate which came first and which came second, and so forth, without looking very carefully at the history of how this disorder evolved over time. And of course, that is a big part in the case taking. Then. In these disorders, multiple or complex disorders. And much of ordinary homeopathy, or you could say classical homeopathy, does not focus on that. It doesn't focus on a thorough history. It may do only a rudimentary history and then try to find out what is it about this patient that resembles a certain medicine. And especially the method that we know in homeopathy as constitutional treatment, where people try to find one single remedy to match the entire constitution of the patient. So they would focus only on the characteristics of the patient and try to find through various approaches the best way to narrow it down to that one single medicine. Unfortunately, though, they ignore the effects that are still there, secondary long-term effects of certain other factors, and the constitutional remedy is dissimilar from those effects, and therefore cannot undo those disorders. And so I came across this dilemma somewhere around the time when I first met you. During the time in those days, we were teaching the constitutional method only in homeopathy. And but I had already begun to evaluate how do you deal with the effects and long-term effects of drugs, medications, vaccines, and so forth. And of course, traditionally in homeopathy, our books only prepared us for the effects of the variola vaccine because that's the only vaccines they had in the 19th century, the smallpox vaccine. That was the only vaccine given in those days. And they had found a similar medicine, Thuja or Thuja occidentalis, made from the Tree of Life, which resembles the symptoms of variola, by the way, and which is had also been employed for the treatment of variola. That medicine was able to undo some of the adverse effects of the variola vaccine. But that did not work in my clinical experience. It did not work when you saw people who had polio, DPT, MMR shots. It did not resemble the picture of smallpox, the chronic picture of smallpox. So that dilemma I resolved by experimenting and learning about the effects of medicines made from the triple vaccines. So those were produced in England. Evidently, someone in England must have thought along the same lines.
So you were able to obtain the homeopathic equivalent of the DPT. DPT, isn't it?
Correct.
Okay.
Some English pharmacies sell those, and certainly also some other European pharmacies sell those, like in Ireland, for example, there's a pharmacy called Helios.
So they are available. You know, as you're talking, I'm listening to all of the things that we as Americans and probably around the world overdo, things like the recommended take your daily dose of aspirin to help your heart,
right,
or the amount of salt or sugar that is as produced in regular processed foods, and people are eating chips and dips and this type of thing and canned goods, and all of them are very high in sodium, and people eat tons of this stuff.
That's right.
So we are impacting our living organism simply by the things in our environment that we don't even realize what's going on, you know, and I think that people are starting to become aware of eating organically, naturally, living foods, whole grain foods, whole foods. This is a trend, and perhaps they will become more aware of the impact that it is having on the body. So your method actually looks at all of the impacts on the body. And, you know, one of the questions that I had is there are people who can perhaps eat a certain diet or take a vaccine and not have an effect, or am I incorrect
That's
in that
right.
thinking?
No, absolutely. Not everyone is susceptible to the same problem, substances and factors. So some people will have a lasting effects from a, let's say a automotive accident, very minor jolt to their neck. Others in the same car have absolutely no effects. Mm-hmm. And let's say this person who did have an effect, well, they had a jolt to the neck. Well, then we need to find the homeopathic remedy for the effects of jolt to the neck, which
right.
Hypericum is a fascinating remedy. Hypericum is the remedy for jolt to the neck, as it is
uh-huh.
for jolt to the spine, a concussion to the spine and so forth, tailbone, spine, and neck. So.
Right.
This is the task, really, is to find out what did happen, and in actuality, we don't need to protect people who do not have any apparent effects for things, although
right.
sometimes effects can be latent, and that's the difficulty in this, and that's why we need to use both the history as well as the symptomatology to find
mm-hmm.
out what needs to be done. So, for example, one of the difficulties today is people use so many suppressive drugs and medications. Some people live off ibuprofen or aspirin. And if you don't look at the history and medication history, you may not know that. You just simply see a patient with no symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
They're perfectly fine. They may even insist
right.
they're fine.
They
but
insist they're fine. They come.
Yeah, but they have this one problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have this one problem they want help with. But they, you know, they're suppressing routinely and habitually one other problem they don't tell you about. So
yeah,
it's definitely important to ask the question, what other medications are you on?
Right.
And what else is going on with you? We do need, as homeopaths, to look at the whole picture.
Right.
And
now,
I've seen physicians, who conventionally trained physicians, who've listened into our lectures and their response is, wow, you people are very thorough.
Mm-hmm.
That's been their response typically. As conventionally trained physicians, they don't really. First of all, I don't have the time to take this kind of history. But certainly, they're not required to go into every detailed symptom. And even to try to figure out. I mean, maybe they should, but they don't routinely do that.
Well, we call it finding the etiology of a problem, and that is part of homeopathic training and care, and it's written in the Organon of Medicine.
Right.
And, you know, when somebody says never well since, or that happened, or this symptom occurred after this particular incident, accident, trauma, or drug. So the etiology, or even a loss, even moving
yeah.
away from your home could cause a chronic illness of depression or something.
Yes.
So.
Well, take one look at the whole issue of painkillers. Same thing with antibiotics. You have one condition, a diagnosis, and then you take something for it, and that's usually the routine prescription in conventional medicine. You know, you come with a pain. Well, yes, sometimes obviously there's some attempt to try to figure out the cause and the nature of this and maybe come up with a diagnosis. But all too often, patients end up with a medication simply that palliates the symptoms.
Mm-hmm. Right. Because
and that's just not enough, really, for good medical care. Theoretically, from a conventional point of view, that's not good medical care. But all too often, that's what happens.
Yeah. So, there's only about 10 minutes or even less time left.
Yes.
Can you, there's about 8 minutes left. How about, what about any scientific studies that support the reverse chronological tautopathy?
Well, there's actually quite a few studies supporting tautopathy. I'm thinking of the studies on arsenic. They were done largely in Indian areas where arsenic was polluting the drinking water in the West Bengal region. And physicians were testing homeopathic medicines made from arsenic to reverse that disorder, the arsenic disorder with ranging anywhere from skin conditions to compromised liver and kidney functions and so forth. And the homeopathic medicine, arsenic in 30C and 200C potencies, showed effects on all levels in removing and reversing these conditions. So there's good scientific evidence that homeopathy is able to reverse and undo both the primary and secondary effects of the toxin in this case. Another study, a series of studies, was done during the Second World War in England when the British Army was exposed to German chemical weapons, like mustard gas. They tested homeopathy and found certain homeopathic remedies, including a tautopathic form of mustard gas, effective in reversing the effects of that poison.
Mm-hmm.
Even isopathic studies show effects in both preventive and treatment and prevention and treatment of the diseases by using, like the most recent you're probably familiar with is the leptospirosis study, which uses leptospirosis in potentized form as a preventive, like as an immunization, you could say, a homeopathic immunization to prevent that disease.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, to my knowledge, I don't know of any reverse chronological study that has yet to be done. In other words, over a series to reverse a series of chronic disorders, and of course, except for my own personal experimentation and also some of my clients, it works very well. But of course, a scientific study would need to look at this objectively and use standard methods of research, including double blinding and placebo control and so forth. It would be very fascinating, very, very, very interesting to see what could be done. And I'd be very interested in someone who wants to come forth and work on a study like that.
That sounds great. Well, it sounds like what we've got in terms of previous experience are individual types of illnesses or experiences such in places that are open to homeopathy, like India, where it is part of the government healthcare program, but it's not as widely known or being willing to happen in America. So these other countries probably would be the place where to institute these types of studies. And so the reasons for using the reverse chronological tautopathy seems pretty obvious from what you've described
right.
so far, that the living organism has had primary effects and secondary effects, if I'm understanding it correctly, and that the secondary effects are the body's effects that can be very lingering and chronic, and it's not going to be able to be removed in any way
right.
unless you're using homeopathic care that or uses the tautopathic medicines, drugs, to release the impact that's changing our vital force, really, and ability for the immune system to function properly and normalize and enable the person to really be free in their fulfilling their lifelong mission of whatever that might be, because they're limited or restricted based on the effects of these drugs. Do you have any other reasons, probably more solid reasons, for using the reverse chronological tautopathy?
Well, I mean, as you mentioned earlier correctly, there are some people who may not have long-term effects from a medication, but more often than not, people don't know about them. That's a big problem, you know, to actually recognize that a problem that shows up 20 years later can actually be from something that was done 20 years ago. That is the most difficult for even doctors to understand, that they don't really get any training in this to see long-term effects of things. I think it can be demonstrated, though, when people, let's say, get a dose of a single tablet of macrodantin and develop thrombocytopenia, which is a reduction in platelet count, and have to be treated with prednisone to stop that because it can be a life-threatening condition. And then, let's say, 5 years later, their platelet count is still down in the 30,000s, whereas normalcy should be over 150,000. That's obvious that this one episode of a medication has induced a chronic disorder that now persists. It did not get cured. It did not get taken care of completely by the prednisone. In fact, the prednisone is still necessary to continue to sustain that. So these are some examples, numerous examples of drug reactions that could be undone by the reverse chronological tautopathy. And chronic disorders, but of course none of this is being looked at because there are multiple complex reasons for why no one is looking at homeopathy. But one of the biggest reasons, I think, is economic. There is simply a reliance, I think, nowadays that is assumed that a certain number of customers are necessary to come into hospitals and into the medical system. It's a huge system, a multi-billion-dollar system. And unfortunately, that's the cold, hard facts. And we're not going to look at real solutions that could reduce and even eliminate some of the problems associated with conventional therapy. But I have seen an increase in the number of people who can simply no longer tolerate conventional medications. They're everywhere. And I'm sure people working in hospitals, they're a nuisance to them because all they have to offer is medication. But they could be treated with homeopathy successfully.
Mm-hmm.
And especially if they come in for the adverse effects of some other treatment, they could certainly be those adverse effects could be undone. And I would think it would save a lot of lawsuits and a lot of grief to do that. I think that should be part of the armamentarium of a conventional medical doctor to simply undo such adverse effects with a simple, inexpensive, and harmless medicine made from the conventional medication, which undoes the reaction.
Well, this has been a very valuable educational experience to speak with you today. Our time has come to an end, and it seems to be ending on a really good note with a lot of questions in my mind to ask you further if you would like to come on again regarding the limitations.
To.
Yeah, that would be great. I've really learned a lot speaking with you today about the reverse chronological tautopathy and what it means and what the potential and what it can do to assist people to recover from short and long-term effects of drugs, medications, and other things from their environment. And I'm going to end the show with our regular signing off, even though it's going to end with Alan Phillips singing his original song. And I will speak to you again. Thank you so much to all of our listeners.
Thank you, Debbie, for having me on your show.
Okay, bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
allow our souls to shine. Listening for the great news of and hearing for mankind. Share your light, let your love be your throne. One by one, we are changing the world. Your truth be young girl. One.